This is Ann Smith, and I am a volunteer with the Sam Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. This is April 10th, 2009, and I'm here with Bob Gasche, G-A-S-C-H-E, and we're going to be doing an interview at the Matheson Museum for the World War II collection. And let me ask you again, since we're doing this since the power failure, your full name.
I'm Robert T. Gasche.
And when were you born?
I was born on December 17th, 1924.
And where?
In Buffalo, New York.
And your father's work?
My father was an electrical engineer with the Bethlehem Steel Company in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. And you were raised with brothers or sisters?
With two sisters.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school in Bradenton, Florida, which is Manatee County, in a school called Ballard Elementary School. From there, I went to Fort Myers, Florida, went to junior high school, which is in Lee County, and then from there to a place called Coral Gables, Florida, where I went to school until the 11th grade. And from that point on, I went into service with the government under the NYA, which is, or was, I should say, the National Youth Administration, who trained young people to do wartime work, such as electric arc welding, which is what I did, at a place called Southeastern Shipbuilding Corporation in Atlanta, Georgia, where I welded in the inner bottom of Liberty ships for about a year and a half.
And when you talked about electric arc, it's ARC.
ARC, right.
And they taught you welding in Atlanta, and you worked on ships, on the Liberty ships, where? Was that in Atlanta, or?
That was in Savannah.
Savannah.
Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Southeastern Shipbuilding. And I went into the interior of ships with the usual helmet, gloves, and a blower for air, and extra light bulbs, and an extension cord, of course, and the torch, and so on. And welded bulkheads in the bottom of the ships. And it was quite confining. And after about a year and a half of that, incidentally, at receiving good money for a teenager, I decided that was enough, and because my eyes were running from catching electric arcs,
mm-hmm,
close to my face. And I went over to the Marine Corps recruiting station and joined the Marines.
What was your thinking? I mean, was it just prevalent that the war was in all of the newspapers, or how did you decide on the Marines over any other branch?
Well, I felt that that was certainly a fighting outfit, and I did want to get into the fighting, being a teenager. And also, I was a Florida cracker, as I said, and I was not prone to snow and ice and the cold weather of the Army that was fighting in Europe. And I saw movies of the Marines fighting on Pacific Islands with beaches and coconut trees, and I said, that's for me. So I joined the Marines.
And that was in what year?
That was in March of 1943.
Well, let me go back just a little bit. Do you remember when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
Yes. I was in Coral Gables, Florida, sitting out in an old Hudson car, and I heard it on a car radio. And I did not have the slightest idea where Pearl Harbor was.
Yeah.
No concept as to what really entailed, other than, you know, hearing it, and it really didn't resonate. The real impact of it did not resonate with me at all.
Did you hear people talking about it, your parents or anybody? And
yes.
And
yes.
Catch their feeling about it?
Well, I can't recollect too much in specifically, but there was a lot of talk about it.
Yeah.
And amazement, and a lot of people really didn't know where Pearl Harbor was.
No,
really.
No.
So, of course, we found out soon enough. But it's even today when I go to classes, high schools all around Gainesville, and I ask the question, how many of you know where Pearl Harbor is? Maybe one or two raise your hand.
Yeah.
They still aren't sure today. Or what does December 7th, 1941 mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
A little vague.
Let me go back another step. And I was wondering, when you were growing up and with your family, what would you characterize the value system in your household? You know, what were important values that your parents, do you think, passed on to you and your sisters?
My father died when I was 12 years old, so primarily it's my mother's characteristics that I felt were significant in my life. And she taught us so much in terms of integrity, of honesty, the value of hard work, and the willingness to reach out to others. She always had a desire to help. And both my sisters and I have picked up on that throughout our lives, what she instilled in us to help others that are in need. And I clearly remember back in those days, people would come to the back door, and she always had a bologna sandwich or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yes.
Something to give them. They didn't go away without a little something.
Yes.
Back then we didn't have an awful lot, but
you shared.
Always had something for them.
Yes.
So we have always been influenced by her love of others and her caring, her outreach to the community, and the idea of sometimes even self-sacrifice when necessary.
When your father died, how did she support the family?
She was able, because of insurance money, to help us. And then I started work at a bakery at 12 years old. I think it was 13. And worked nights at a bakery and went to school in the daytime. But the dean let me have a study hall for the first 2 hours of school so I could sleep in the first hour, because I had worked at night until about 5 in the morning at a bakery on a wrapping and slicing machine in South Miami. So it kind of worked out where I didn't get a nap in before school for me started.
But that was hard work even starting out as a young man.
It was pretty time consuming, but I was able to bring in a little money to help out.
Sure.
And I was thankful for that, because my salary was $12 a week.
$12 a week.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was working nights in a bakery, in a wrapping and slicing machine, getting the bread ready for the trucks. It would come about 3:30 in the morning pick up their allotment of bread to be delivered.
Did that enter into your decision to maybe leave before you graduated?
No.
You went into the youth organization because you wanted to...
I wanted to participate in some way into the war effort. And also my family, since my father had died, certainly could use the money.
Certainly.
And I was able to send pretty good money home. from electric arc welding.
Yes.
So, you know, there were, I guess, a dual desire.
Sure, sure. And then when you entered the Marine Corps, where did you do your basic training?
Well, I was originally scheduled to go to Parris Island, South Carolina, but that was under quarantine at that time. So they took about a dozen of us, put us on a train, and headed us out to San Diego, California, where, the Marine Corps Recruit Depot was located. And I did not know at that time, but I was to be branded forever as a Hollywood Marine. And I've never lived it down. And the guys I associate with will not let me live it down.
Somehow that was softer basic training than anyone else had. Is
well, the Parris Island perceived it as such. Really, it was pretty rough. It didn't matter, you know, if it was Marine training, whether it was San Diego or Parris Island. But it was a geographical disparity because Parris Island was somewhat isolated. It was a marshland. It was full of mosquitoes, and there was no place to go on liberty, and it was not metropolitan, whereas San Diego was metropolitan, surrounded by a place called Hollywood, and of course, it had barrage balloons with cables hanging down overhead because of the war threat. And it was very urban setting with the city right adjacent to the Marine base. And, of course, the Parris Island Marines felt that we had liberty to go out and have parties and associate with. Well, that, of course, never happened. We never had liberty. And so, but still that for, if you will, rivalry prevailed, and they labeled us Hollywood Marines.
And tell me about your basic training. How long was it, and what did that entail?
It was 9 weeks, and it entailed a lot of close order drilling, a lot of physical training, a lot of discipline, and some brutality. I say that because, for example, if at mail call, if you got a letter from your girlfriend and there was lipstick on the back of the letter, it was sealed with lipstick, you were made to put a bucket over your head, repeat words that I will not repeat.
Oh my goodness.
And run down between tents. And the tents had ropes and stakes. And, of course, a bucket over your head, you couldn't see, and you fell into those ropes and stakes, and you were forced to get up and keep running no matter what. But that was part of the training and the discipline that prevailed back then. It's one of the guys who can get hurt, but that's what they did, and you were, you know, you were no longer a citizen with rights and that you were a low-level recruit training to become a Marine. It was taught to kill. And again, part of our training was rifle range, where we were taught to use the M1 rifle. And also the bayonet, hand grenades and stuff like that. Weapon training, a lot of physical training and drill, close order drill, and certainly an awful lot of discipline. For example, you were take a shower. You were run into a building that was probably 100 feet long, and there was no nice hot shower. There was a pipe in the wall with cold water coming out. And you had 2 minutes to use GI soap, which was laced with lye. And you had to take your so-called shower and be out of there because there was 100 guys waiting, you know, to get in.
Yeah.
So you were kind of rushed through there and given shots, 2 in each arm, all that transitional stuff, you know.
Yeah. But, as far as you know, did most everyone in your unit get through basic training, or were there some dropouts?
There were dropouts, yeah. Some guys just couldn't take it. And I forget the number. It was a handful at the most, not many. Most guys made it, but there were some that just simply couldn't take it.
And when you were finished with basic training, then where were you assigned?
I was assigned to a guard company on North Island, which is an island just off of San Diego, California. And we were there to guard the beach, which at that time was a threat as far as a Japanese invasion.
Sure.
And we had guard towers. We were given machine guns. And we were had a spotlight and a telephone up in the guard tower. And we were there to repel, if you will, any attempt at an infiltration or an invasion. And then also we were required to do crash duty when naval planes would, and there were a number of them on this North Island, when they crashed, we were the crash crew. And we would go to the crash site and pull out the bodies or the wounded, or put ropes around the plane so people wouldn't, in case of exploding ammunition, wouldn't get hurt. Of course, we were expendable. we were.
You kind of figured that out, didn't you?
Yeah. What about?
Yeah.
You go in there and you do your job, though.
Yeah.
We did that. Then from there, I went to Camp Pendleton, California, and started training as a member of the 5th Marine Division.
And did you have a specific responsibility? Were you, did you have just generalized training, or was it specific in some?
Well, it was both. A lot of it was basic training. Where we did an awful lot of physical things like mountain climbing and learning to jump off of a ship. We had a tower over our pool, and also how to climb down cargo nets.
Yes.
Without getting hurt or stepped on.
Yes.
And then, yes, it was specific as well because I was a rifleman.
Okay.
And I was trained to use the M1 rifle on the rifle range. Also, grenade training, bayonet training, use of demolitions, and how to use a bazooka and mortars. And familiarization with other weapons, such as a Browning automatic rifle, or the Thompson submachine gun, the Colt 45.
Goodness.
The carbine, and Browning 30 caliber machine gun. And the medium 30 caliber machine gun, and then some familiarization of the 81 millimeter mortars, as well as a 60 millimeter mortar.
Gracious.
So we were given a lot of training on weaponry, because in combat, if guys were killed that had a certain responsibility for a weapon, if we knew how to fill in for them, our job was to do that.
Yes.
And we were given sufficient training to do that.
I can see that. What about hand-to-hand combat?
Oh, yes. We had, again, bayonet training, knife training, some hand-to-hand training, so that if we should get into contact, contact with the enemy, we could hold our own, at least. Excuse me.
That's
all right. So, yes, we were physically capable of doing that, and we were very confident that if we got into close quarters with the enemy, we were capable of doing away with them. In other words, kill them.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, how long was that training then at the North Island?
Oh, on North Island? Now, this training didn't take place in North Island. This is
at Camp Pendleton. I beg your pardon.
Yes. Camp Pendleton. I think it was a year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yes.
Because we shipped out to from there with the 26th Marines to go to the island of Guam in that battle, but they didn't need us. They turned the ship around and sent us back to Hawaii. So
when did you leave for Guam?
I
don't remember those.
Somewhere in 44.
Yes, uh-huh. And so when they didn't need you in Guam, then you came back to Camp Pendleton?
We came back to Hilo, Hawaii.
Oh, I see.
And we set up a place called Camp Tarawa.
Uh-huh.
Which is near Mauna Kea, one of the major volcanoes of the Hawaiian Islands.
Uh-huh.
There are two there, Mauna Kea.
Uh-huh.
And we set up a base camp there called Camp Tarawa.
Uh-huh. And how many of, was it a large unit that was on?
Yes, it was a whole 5th Marine Division.
I see.
Roughly 20,000 men.
So the whole division was there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I had read something about the spearhead.
Yes, that was the, if you will, the... byword, but the, not the right word, the logo for the 5th Marine Division.
I see.
Yeah. It was...
So you were known as the Spearhead?
As the Spearhead Division.
And so that was the whole division that was called that?
Yes, Yes. I have a sample I'll bring you, show you what it looks like.
Okay, that sounds good. I'd like that. We'll get some of that other memorabilia and some of the pictures mm-hmm. to include to augment some of these stories. and so you were on the island there, and then mm-hmm. you got orders to ship out,
mm-hmm.
and was the whole division, is that right?
The whole division was shipped out, I forget the exact date, Hilo, Hawaii.
From Hilo.
We had taken our training there deliberately on the volcano Mauna Kea because the ash lava from the volcano was somewhat similar to Mount Suribachi on the island of Iwo Jima.
So that was...
And we did not know that, of course, at that time, but the...
That was the thinking of...
Yes. So we took training there in the ash. But there was an interesting incident. And we were issued in Hawaii winter overcoats. We were at such a high elevation that it was, it was cold. And we had blankets issued and... winter overcoats and heavy gear because of the high elevation on Hawaii. It was amazing.
So you weren't expecting that from your movies about the Pacific?
No way.
They didn't say anything about volcanoes in the recruitment, did they?
No, they didn't mention that, but it occurred. Now, down at the beach level, it was, of course, typical.
Yes.
70s, 80s, or whatever. And it was nice. And once in a while, they did let us go down there to swim.
Uh-huh.
And took us down in trucks.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately, there was a current, a heavy tide, and we lost a couple of guys that got life raft. And... We never. One guy was able to swim in and survive, but I think there were two that they never found, even though they sent out planes and certainly boats, and they never found them again.
Oh, dear.
We lost two guys.
Oh, dear.
Also, during maneuvers on Hawaii, Apparently they had put some ammunition into our artillery, in which this was live fire maneuvers, and they fired supposedly ahead of us, and then we were to move up. Well, the powder and the ammunition was old powder, probably from World War I, and it fired what we call short rounds, and it landed among us. And we lost some guys also from that. In fact, one was just over a small ridge and from my squad. And it was very close. And we had several wounded and some killed.
Oh, dear.
Our squad was lucky. They just missed us.
So that's friendly fire accidents that happen.
Exactly. So those things happen, of course, during training. And,
but they're just as permanent as if they happen on the battlefield.
That's true.
Were you given any first aid treatment? I mean, you were trained to... Did you have a pack, a first aid pack that you carried when you went into combat?
Yes, every Marine had what they called a first aid pack on his cartridge belt.
Uh-huh.
We had our ammunition, we had a K-bar knife, we had two canteens of water, and a first aid pack. And we were trying to do rudimentary first aid. And
yes.
Also, once in combat, you were given a little tube of morphine,
uh-huh.
which you could inject yourself with to help ease the pain of a wound. However, we were very fortunate in that every platoon had a well-trained corpsman.
Mm-hmm.
And these corpsmen were wonderful. They were just great. And they were the ones that came to us when we were hurt or wounded or sick or broke a bone or whatever. And they did their jobs and did it well, even though they had to go under fire to get to us. They did their jobs, and many of them were killed in combat
mm-hmm.
because they had to go to the wounded men. Well,
I heard
right there.
Sure, I've heard that over and over again.
Yes.
Yes.
They were wonderful.
So how did you find out about your orders then to leave this island and that the plans for Iwo Jima?
We were given the order to pack up and get ready to move out. We were given no destination, nothing other than get ready to move out. And it's interesting you ask that because we were put on banana trains. And they were small trains that went down through ravines and really mountains there in Hawaii. And as we slowly moved towards Hilo Harbor, where the troop transport the Hawaiian people had heard about us moving out. They threw mangoes, papayas,
really?
All kinds of fruit to us because they were only about 4 or 5 feet higher than we were, and they just gave us everything, you know, fruit to have, melons, whatever they had. They lined up along there and threw the fruit to us. And when we got to the harbor, we were told to get ready to go aboard ship. And then all of a sudden we got the word, no, you're not going to our ship, go back up into the hills. Well, we were mystified.
Sure.
What's going on? Well, we found out later that sabotage had occurred on one of the ships in the harbor, and they had military police go in, and a bunch of them, and they had to go through the ship, and they found a package of matches that had been wrapped up with, I think, sandpaper around them. So if they rubbed against anything, the matches would
explode,
ignite, and start a fire. So they had to unload the ship while we were waiting up in the
hill. Oh, dear.
And finally, they cleared the ship, and we did get aboard. So that was an interesting start.
I guess.
Then from there, we went to the island of Maui, which is an adjacent island to the big island of Hawaii, which is where we were. And we did some maneuvers there with the 4th Marine Division, which had been stationed at Maui. From there, we went to Pearl Harbor, Oahu, and 1/4 of us at a time got liberty. Well, we didn't know it at that time, but all the young Hawaiian girls, even those who went to the University of Hawaii, had been told the Marines were coming, and they sent them off up into the hills because they told them that we raped them. And so when we got into Honolulu, there were no young girls.
Really?
Older people.
Yeah.
And people selling, whiskey, doing tattoos and photographs, things like that. But the young girls were gone. We didn't know as to why. But we did get liberty, and then we boarded ship and headed for an island called Aniwetok. Well, about 2 days, Aniwetok. 2 days at sea, they told us we were going to hit the island of Iwo Jima at sea. That's when we learned where we were going.
And what did you know about what was going on there? Did they keep you up to date about the progress of the war, or did you...
We knew absolutely nothing. No, nothing. Now, we did have a newspaper called Stars and Stripes, which was put out by the Army, I'm pretty sure, but it was a very general thing and talked about Europe mostly and what was happening somewhat in the Pacific, but we didn't know anything about Iwo Jima.
Sure,
or
sure.
Other islands, Saipan, Tinian.
Yes.
Had been hit. And the island of Guam, although we knew we had been headed towards Guam, but where the 3rd Marine Division hit. And of course, the 4th Marine Division hit, along with an Army 27th Division, hit Saipan and Tinian.
So it wasn't until we
were out of sea for security purposes, they told us we were headed for one of the Bonin Islands, and that was Iwo Jima.
And what, now, when they brief you about what your job is or what to expect, what were you told?
Mostly topographical information. Texture of the soil, the Mount Suribachi, 550-foot volcano on the southern end of the island, the expanse of the island, which was about 7.5 miles long, and at widest point about 1.5 miles wide, where we would hit, which was called Red Beach 1. It was Red Beach 1, Red Beach 2.
Yes.
We had been told that they had been bombarded for 72 days by bombs and also by ships at sea, and had been strafed and certainly would on D-Day would get an intensive bombardment from rocket ships and so forth. So it was generally information that related to the topography and not as much as we could have used in terms of the enemy.
That was my next question.
Yes. I wish we had received more. I don't remember. There were about 21,000 Japanese on the... 22,000, excuse me, on the island. We didn't know that.
Sure.
We certainly had no idea about the complexity of the underground tunnels and what they had done to create, if you will, a living environment deep underground that would sustain them during this heavy bombardment from the ships at sea. Big 16-inch shells, rockets, bombs, you name it.
Sure.
And we had no idea how deeply the General Kiribati, who was their and a brilliant general, how he had made them go underground, and even they had their hospitals, they had their sleeping areas, they had interconnected tunnels, everything practically was underground. And the thing was, we were on Iwo Jima. They were in Iwo Jima, and that was so true.
That was probably the best way to say it.
Yeah, they were in it, and we had to dig them out. But one of the big helps we had, believe it or not, were dogs. They had in existence something called the K-9 Corps, capital K-9, maybe you've heard of it.
Yes.
And they were mainly Dobermans and Doberman pincers and German police dogs. Well, they were terrific because they were trained to go into these tunnels and into these caves and tear those Japanese apart.
Yes.
Which they did.
Yes.
And we were able to get them to chase those Japanese out. And once they came running out, then they were exposed.
Yes.
And we could cut them down with our rifles and machine guns, which we did. But those dogs were wonderful. They saved a lot of lives as far as we're concerned.
No doubt.
Because in terms of this underground tunnels and caves and so on, we had to go in with flamethrowers. We had to go in with demolition squads and blow them out. And it was, or hand grenades. And it was very dangerous to do so because they had set up their firing ports where one was a crossfire from one would connect with the other.
With the other.
So that if you attack this cave, that cave over there was zeroed in on.
Yes.
So we had to button up all we could with automatic rifle fire in all those caves and tunnels.
Can you describe how it was on when you landed, the day you landed?
Yes, it was, and I gave you an article about that.
Yes,
I wrote that about that. It was a very nice, it wasn't a bad day that morning. It got rougher in the afternoon. Sun was shining. The sea was not too rough. Our LCVP, which is well known as a Higgins boat, had, you know, roughly 30 guys on it. We had a coxswain driving us in. We were under fire partly, nothing real close. So however, some Higgins boats did get hit in the water coming in, and they died, all of them died pretty well. We did make it in. Our Higgins boat hit the shore, the ramp went down, and there were dead Marines rolling in the, I'll never forget that, rolling in the waves that surfed. And it was pretty well shell pop. Casualties were prevalent on the beach, and there were a number of dead Marines, quite a number, and wounded Marines on the shore on the invasion beach. And we were looking for a place to jump into, and there wasn't any, hardly, because the sand was so soft. If you tried to dig in, and I've written an article about this, like an anthill, you know, the sand would fill in the hole you dug.
This is the volcanic ash,
yes,
is that right?
Yes, volcanic ash, right, very soft, and like coffee grounds. So we would run in, look for a shell hole to try to dive into a shell hole. But it was, I did not go in on the first wave. I think it was about the sixth wave, I'm pretty sure, but I'm not positive. And The first three waves got in okay. General Kuribachi let them in. But then he opened up, and that's when we caught it. From Mount Suribachi down on us on Red and Green Beach in the northern highlands around Catano Point, we were subjected to their fire. So we had crossfire from both ends, mm-hmm. and the casualties. It was a killing field. It really was, because we, even though we had fired on Mount Suribachi, hundreds, maybe thousands of times, they were still in those caves protected, and they would come out, they would fire, and go back in. And they certainly turned loose on us everything they had. Not the first three waves, but, you know, the later waves.
Yes.
And so our objective was to cut across the island and pivot to the right, mm-hmm. and head towards the other end of the island, uh-huh. actually for Motoyama number one, which mm-hmm. is the airfield. The 28th Marines, I was in the 26th Marines, they pivoted left and eventually went up Mount Suribachi, and it was a group from the 28th Marines, excuse me, that, you know, planted the flag.
Yes.
Now famous.
Now, that was that the first day you landed? That was that was way later, wasn't it?
Yeah, that that was the 23rd. We landed on February the 19th, 1945. The flag went up on the 23rd. Mm-hmm. That was the easy company from the 28th Marines.
Now, when you remember those first days, I'm trying to think, was it pretty steady fighting and combat, or were there times when you felt like you could rest, or did you get any sleep during those times?
No. There was no sleep. We were under fire. It was a matter of survival, trying to fulfill our duty, that is, move forward across the island.
Yes.
But we were constantly under mortar fire, artillery fire. I think I told you I was buried up to here.
Yes.
One time, and so many of the guys were wounded or killed in the process. But at night it was very hard, because they infiltrated, and they would come in and get close to your foxhole and drop a grenade or stick a bayonet in there, whatever they could do. Now, we did have what they call magnesium flares that were fired from ships usually, and they did provide some illumination, but even so, there were times when it was pitch dark and the enemy could move, well, crawl on their belly, actually, across the ground and come in and get you in your foxhole.
So you couldn't sleep?
No. There was no sleeping during that period. Now, you had what's called two-man foxholes.
Yes.
And your buddy was supposed to be on the alert 2 hours, then you were supposed to, that's a joke, sleep 2 hours,
yes.
which you couldn't. And then he would, you know, relieve each other. Mm-hmm. But there was not sleep. You might not be as sensitive and as alert during your off period, your two, but you still had your bayonet handy and your weapon ready. And, you know,
sure,
and
sure.
You had the noises of firing at night and
yes.
rifles and machine guns on that. So it was not a restful period. In other words, there wasn't, to answer your question, there was not a restful period available, no.
And you grabbed what you could to eat on the way?
Yes, food became a very minuscule item. I don't remember having much of an appetite. Yes, we had food. We had what called K rations. They were pretty bad. But you could grab what they called a energy bar, which mm-hmm. was chocolate, one of them. One was fruits and nuts. And And they had beans in a can, or breakfast one had eggs in it, but they were all pretty bad. We didn't think much of them. we did nibble on things now and then, but our appetite was subdued due to the trauma
sure.
that was so prevalent
sure.
in our lives.
Now, could the corpsmen get to the wounded, and how were they evacuated?
The corpsmen were great. They risked their lives by running, crawling, sliding on their belly, whatever they could do to get to a wounded man.
Mm-hmm.
And they would dress their wounds, or they would close their eyes and put something over them if they were dead. But when they had a wounded man that had to be evacuated, they would call for stretcher bearers.
Uh-huh.
And these were guys that were generally clerks or bandsmen or men that had burial detail duties. And they would come up with stretchers, and they would put you on it and mm-hmm. carry you back to the beach. But unfortunately, in the process, many guys were either killed or wounded again in that process, because the beach was not a safe haven.
I was going to say they would be vulnerable the minute they...
Very. And sometimes the buddies would get under, pick a guy up and take him back.
Yeah.
A wounded guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you helped each other. But mostly corpsmen did the duties
mm-hmm.
and stretcher
mm-hmm.
bearers. So when I was hit, corpsmen came up and treated me. I vaguely remember. And
now, when you were hit, how many days had you been in combat?
Roughly halfway through the battle, a couple of weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway through the battle.
And what had happened? Was that... You know what happened when you were wounded?
I really don't remember too much. I was I was vertical, moving forward. We just started a push that morning, and we were moving out. We were under fire, and the next split second, I was flat on my belly, helpless,
uh-huh.
because the shrapnel had hit my belt buckle and carried that in with it and went into my guts.
Uh-huh.
So I don't remember too much. But the corpsman, later,
mm-hmm.
came up. I believe he must have given me morphine, because I don't remember a lot.
Uh-huh.
And eventually stretcher bearers did come up, pick me up, put me on stretchers, and somehow we got back to a battalion aid station where they examined me. Then I went on a jeep. They had what they call a jeep stretcher rig or something. It had stretchers
yes.
on it.
Yes.
And we got back to the beach. And then I don't remember too much, except that I got on a Higgins boat.
Yes.
With others. Now, it wasn't me alone.
Yes.
We went out to, I think it was the USS Hope, a hospital ship.
Yes.
They dropped cables down. They hooked up the stretchers on hoisters up to the deck. And they looked at my tag, and on my tag it said critical. So they hustled me right to the operating room, I'm pretty sure.
Uh-huh.
And this I do remember now. The doctor said, I want you to start to count to 10. No, I want you to count to 10. And I do remember this. And he took a piece of ball of cotton, and he had a can of ether.
Uh-huh.
And he laced the ether with, cotton with ether.
Yes.
And he shoved it in my face. And that's the last I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Till whenever it was over.
What day? Do you know the date you were wounded?
No, I don't.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember. I'm
uh-huh.
sorry.
I just wondered if you knew. And
about half
so you were on the hospital ship after
yes.
you had surgery.
Yes, and I was operated on there because when your guts are hit with a bullet or shrapnel, the big concern is a penetration of the intestines.
Yes.
If the intestines are perforated, they must, so that the waste from the body won't go into the tissues and poison you and all.
Mm-hmm.
They must sew that up.
Yes.
And I was very, very lucky. The doctor told me later that I had, the shrapnel had missed my intestines by an eighth of an inch.
Mm.
And I didn't have to have them sewn.
Uh-huh.
So they just left it all in me and sewed me up.
Uh-huh.
And we headed, whenever it was, I don't know, when the ship headed for Guam, I went into an army hospital. And they put us on cots.
Mm-hmm.
And they were tents on Guam, the island of Guam.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, though, I guess I was a pretty bad patient because one night I remember screaming in a hazy sort of way because I knew Japanese were over my head, coming into me with bayonets.
Oh, really?
I knew that, and I was screaming, and next thing I knew, there was an army nurse there with a needle, and she injected me with morphine, and
mm-hmm.
that was it.
Uh-huh.
But eventually, I was able to have some mobility and walk
uh-huh.
a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And they had outdoor movies, black and white,
yes.
for the hospital patients and the troops. And we saw movies like Bob Hope, you know, and
sure.
Bing Crosby,
sure.
The Road to Zanzibar. Well, these were highly enjoyed, not so much by us, but by Japanese up in the hills just over our heads that had been left on the island after the island of Guam was captured.
Really?
And they loved our movies. They clapped and they cheered and they whistled. They were the ones that enjoyed our movies.
And, isn't that know, amazing?
We weren't, you know, going up in the jungle after them.
Yeah.
Know. They were just, they weren't bothering anyone.
No.
They were just having fun watching our Bob Hope movies.
Oh, gosh.
So that was fun. But then...
So how long were you on Guam after your...
I'm guessing a couple of weeks.
Weeks, uh-huh.
Sure. But yeah. Then they loaded us on a C-54 transport hospital plane. Maybe, did I tell you the story?
A little bit.
Do you want me to?
Not. Yeah, I want to know. Yes. Yes.
Okay, and I told you about the red-haired army nurse.
Yeah. Now you were. How many patients does this plane hold? A lot.
A lot. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't have any idea.
It's a large hospital plane.
I was flat on my back, sort of on a stretcher, even though I had gone to movies, but I hobbled with a crane.
Sure.
Crutch.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we were on stretchers, and we didn't know it, but I knew one engine went out because I was by a window. And we didn't know it, but another engine had gone out. So luckily, a C-54 has four engines. Otherwise, we'd have been shark bait. And the pilots had put on their May West jacket and radioed in a mayday. And we luckily somehow made it into with this crippled plane. And thanks to that army nurse who was just wonderful, we made it into an island called Johnston Island,
uh-huh.
which is about 1,000 miles or so off of Pearl Harbor.
Uh-huh.
They did have an airstrip, and we landed there, and they made repairs. I don't know how long it took.
Uh-huh. But, and you stayed on the plane, or did you?
Yeah,
did
we stayed on the plane.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how long. And then they okayed it, and we flew on into Pearl Harbor.
Uh-huh.
And went to Aiea Heights Hospital, where we were again examined.
Uh-huh.
And then those of us who were badly wounded were put aboard a ship, and I don't know the name of it. And we were sent back to the States, actually San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And the news that I remember the most was that while we were aboard ship between Pearl Harbor and San Francisco, we got word that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had died. He was the only president we really knew.
Of course.
And that was very sad. And so...
did your family know about any of this, or had they been communicated with?
We had a Red Cross lady that came around to each stretcher on Guam, and she would write a letter for you. We couldn't write. And she would send that letter to the address of your parents.
Uh-huh.
So they knew from the Red Cross lady that we had been wounded.
Uh-huh.
We couldn't say where or what island, but, you know, we had been wounded and we were alive. And we couldn't say where we were headed or anything like that.
Yes.
But we were alive, those of us that, of course, could.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they did. And then I found out later my mother had written the Marine headquarters and they had responded. And I have a copy of that letter. That I had been wounded and attended to.
Mm-hmm.
So the...